realized, in the worst way she could. "You took something from me a long time ago, Sayuri. How does it feel now?" she said. Her nostrils were flared, her face consumed with anger like a burning twig. It was as though the spirit of Hatsumomo had been living trapped inside her all these years and had finally broken free. During the rest of that evening, I remember nothing but a blur of events and how much I dreaded every moment ahead of me. While the others sat around drinking and laughing, it was all I could do to pretend to laugh. I must have spent the entire night flushed red, because from time to time Mameha touched my neck to see if I was feverish. I'd seated myself as far away from the chairman as I could, so that our eyes would never have to meet, and I did manage to make it through the evening without confronting him. But later, as we were all preparing for bed, I stepped into the hallway as he was coming back into the room. I ought to have moved out of his way, but I felt so ashamed I gave a brief bow and hurried past him instead, making no effort to hide my unhappiness. It was an evening of torment, and I remember only one other thing about it. At some point, after everyone else was asleep, I wandered away from the inn in a daze and ended up on the sea cliffs, staring out into the darkness with the sound of the roaring water below me. The thundering of the ocean was like a bitter lament. I seemed to see beneath everything a layering of cruelty I'd never known was there, as though the trees and the wind and even the rocks where I stood were all in alliance with my old girlhood enemy, Hatsumomo. The howling of the wind and the shaking of the trees seemed to mock me. Could it really be that the stream of my life had divided forever? I removed the chairman's handkerchief from my sleeve, for I'd taken it to bed that evening to comfort myself one last time. I dried my face with it and held it up into the wind. I was about to let it dance away into the darkness when I thought of the tiny mortuary tablets that Mr. Tanaka had sent me so many years earlier. We must always keep something to remember those who have left us. The mortuary tablets back in the Okia were all that remained of my childhood. The chairman's handkerchief would be what remained of the rest of my life. Back in Kyoto, I was carried along in a current of activity over the next few days. I had no choice but to put on my makeup as usual and attend engagements at the tea houses, just as though nothing had changed in the world. I kept reminding myself that Mameha had once told me that there was nothing like work for getting over disappointment, but my work didn't seem to help me in any way. Every time I went into the Ichiriki tea house, I was reminded that one day soon, Nobu would summon me there to tell me the arrangements had been settled at last. Considering how busy he'd been over the past few months, I didn't expect to hear from him for some time, a week or two perhaps. But on Wednesday morning, 3 days after our return from Amami, I received word that Iwamura Electric had telephoned the Ichiriki tea house to request my presence that evening. I dressed late in the afternoon in a yellow kimono of silk gauze with a green underrobe and a deep blue obi interwoven with gold threads. Auntie assured me I looked lovely, but when I saw myself in the mirror, I seemed like a woman defeated. I'd certainly experienced moments in the past when I felt displeased with the way I looked before setting out from the Okia, but most often I managed to find at least one feature I could make use of during the course of the evening. A certain persimmon-colored underrobe, for example, always brought out the blue in my eyes, rather than the gray, no matter how exhausted I felt. But this evening, my face seemed utterly hollow beneath my cheekbones, although I'd put on Western-style makeup just as I usually did, and even my hairstyle seemed lopsided to me. I couldn't think of any way to improve my appearance other than asking Mr. Beku to retie my obi just a finger's width higher to take away some of my downcast look. My first engagement was a banquet given by an American colonel to honor the new governor of Kyoto Prefecture. It was held at the former estate of the Sumitomo family, which was now the headquarters of the American Army's 7th Division. I was amazed to see that so many of the beautiful stones in the garden were painted white, and signs in English, which of course I couldn't read, were tacked to the trees here and there. After the party was over, I made my way to the Ichiriki and was shown upstairs by a maid to the same peculiar little room where Nobu had met with me on the night Gion was closing. This was the very spot where I'd learned about the haven he'd found to keep me safe from the war. It seemed entirely appropriate that we should meet in this same room to celebrate his becoming my Donna, though it would be anything but a celebration for me. I knelt at one end of the table so that Nobu would sit facing the alcove. I was careful to position myself so he could pour sake using his one arm without the table in his way. He would certainly want to pour a cup for me after telling me the arrangements had been finalized. It would be a fine night for Nobu. I would do my best not to spoil it. With the dim lighting and the reddish cast from the tea-colored walls, the atmosphere was really quite pleasant. I'd forgotten the very particular scent of the room, a combination of dust and the oil used for polishing wood, but now that I smelled it again, I found myself remembering details about that evening with Nobu years earlier that I couldn't possibly have called to mind otherwise. He had holes in both of his socks, I remembered. Through one, a slender big toe had protruded, with the nail neatly groomed. Could it really be that only 5.5 years had passed since that evening? It seemed an entire generation had come and gone. So many of the people I'd once known were dead. Was this the life I'd come back to Gion to lead? It was just as Mameha had once told me. We don't become geisha because we want our lives to be happy. We become geisha because we have no choice. If my mother had lived, I might be a wife and mother at the seashore myself, thinking of Kyoto as a faraway place where the fish were shipped. And would my life really be any worse? Nobu had once said to me, "I'm a very easy man to understand, Sayuri. I don't like things held up before me that I cannot have." Perhaps I was just the same. All my life in Gion, I'd imagined the chairman before me, and now I could not have him. After 10 or 15 minutes of waiting for Nobu, I began to wonder if he was really coming. I knew I shouldn't do it, but I laid my head down on the table to rest, for I'd slept poorly these past nights. I didn't fall asleep, but I did drift for a time in my general sense of misery, and then I seemed to have a most peculiar dream. I thought I heard the tapping sound of drums in the distance, and a hiss like water from a faucet, and then I felt the chairman's hand touching my shoulder. I knew it was the chairman's hand because when I lifted my head from the table to see who had touched me, he was there. The tapping had been his footsteps. The hissing was the door in its track. And now he stood above me, with a maid waiting behind him. I bowed and apologized for falling asleep. I felt so confused that for a moment I wondered if I was really awake, but it wasn't a dream. The chairman was seating himself on the very cushion where I'd expected Nobu to sit, and yet Nobu was nowhere to be seen. While the maid placed sake on the table, an awful thought began to take hold in my mind. Had the chairman come to tell me Nobu had been in an accident, or that some other horrible thing had happened to him? Otherwise, why hadn't Nobu himself come? I was about to ask the chairman when the mistress of the tea-house peered into the room. "Why, chairman," she said, "we haven't seen you in weeks." The mistress was always pleasant in front of guests, but I could tell from the strain in her voice that she had something else on her mind. Probably she was wondering about Nobu just as I was. While I poured sake for the chairman, the mistress came and knelt at the table. She stopped his hand before he took a sip from his cup and leaned toward him to breathe in the scent of the vapors. "Really, chairman, I never understand why you prefer this sake to others," she said. "We opened some this afternoon, the best we've had in years. I'm sure Nobu-san will appreciate it when he arrives."
"I'm sure he would," the chairman said. "Nobu appreciates fine things, but he won't be coming tonight."
I was alarmed to hear this, but I kept my eyes to the table. I could see that the mistress was surprised, too, because of how quickly she changed the subject. "Oh, well," she said. "Anyway, don't you think our Sayuri looks charming this evening?"
"Now, mistress, when has Sayuri not looked charming?" said the chairman. "Which reminds me, let me show you something I've brought."
The chairman put onto the table a little bundle wrapped in blue silk. I hadn't noticed it in his hand when he'd entered the room. He untied it and took out a short, fat scroll, which he began to unroll. It was cracked with age and showed, in miniature, brilliantly colored scenes of the imperial court. If you've ever seen this sort of scroll, you'll know that you can unroll it all the way across a room and survey the entire grounds of the imperial compound,
from the gates at one end to the palace at the other. The chairman sat with it before him, unrolling it from one spindle to the other, past scenes of drinking parties and aristocrats playing kickball with their kimonos cinched up between their legs, until he came to a young woman in her lovely 12-layered robes, kneeling on the wood floor outside the emperor's chambers.
"Now what do you think of that?" he said.
"It's quite a scroll," the mistress said. "Where did the chairman find it?"
"Oh, I bought it years ago. But look at this woman right here. She's the reason I bought it. Don't you notice anything about her?"
The mistress peered at it. Afterward, the chairman turned it for me to see. The image of the young woman, though no bigger than a large coin, was painted in exquisite detail. I didn't notice it at first, but her eyes were pale. And when I looked more closely, I saw they were blue-gray. They made me think at once of the works Uchida had painted using me as a model. I blushed and muttered something about how beautiful the scroll was. The mistress admired it too for a moment, and then said,
"Well, I'll leave the two of you. I'm going to send up some of that fresh chilled sake I mentioned, unless you think I should save it for the next time Nobu-san comes."
"Don't bother," he said. "We'll make do with the sake we have."
"Nobu-san is quite all right, isn't he?"
"Oh, yes," said the chairman. "Quite all right."
I was relieved to hear this, but at the same time I felt myself growing sick with shame. If the chairman hadn't come to give me news about Nobu, he'd come for some other reason, probably to berate me for what I'd done. In the few days since returning to Kyoto, I'd tried not to imagine what he must have seen, the minister with his pants undone, me with my bare legs protruding from my disordered kimono. When the mistress left the room, the sound of the door closing behind her was like a sword being drawn from its sheath.
"May I please say, Chairman," I began as steadily as I could, "that my behavior on Amami—"
"I know what you're thinking, Sayuri, but I haven't come here to ask for your apology. Sit quietly a moment. I want to tell you about something that happened quite a number of years ago."
"Chairman, I feel so confused," I managed to say. "Please forgive me, but—"
"Just listen. You'll understand soon enough why I'm telling it to you. Do you recall a restaurant named Tsumio? It closed toward the end of the Depression. But, well, never mind. You were very young at the time. In any case, one day, quite some years ago, 18 years ago to be exact, I went there for lunch with several of my associates. We were accompanied by a certain geisha named Izuko from the Pontocho district."
I recognized Izuko's name at once.
"She was everybody's favorite back in those days," the chairman went on. "We happened to finish up our lunch a bit early, so I suggested we take a stroll by the Shirakawa stream on our way to the theater."
By this time, I'd removed the chairman's handkerchief from my obi, and now, silently, I spread it onto the table and smoothed it so that his monogram was clearly visible. Over the years, the handkerchief had taken on a stain in one corner, and the linen had yellowed, but the chairman seemed to recognize it at once. His words trailed off, and he picked it up.
"Where did you get this?"
"Chairman," I said, "all these years I've wondered if you knew I was the little girl you'd spoken to. You gave me your handkerchief that very afternoon, on your way to see the play, Shibaraku. You also gave me a coin."
"Do you mean to say, even when you were an apprentice, you knew that I was the man who'd spoken to you?"
"I recognized the chairman the moment I saw him again at the sumo tournament. To tell the truth, I'm amazed the chairman remembered me."
"Well, perhaps you ought to look at yourself in the mirror sometime, Sayuri, particularly when your eyes are wet from crying, because they become... I can't explain it. I felt I was seeing right through them. You know, I spend so much of my time seated across from men who are never quite telling me the truth, and here was a girl who'd never laid eyes on me before, and yet was willing to let me see straight into her."
And then the chairman interrupted himself.
"Didn't you ever wonder why Mameha became your older sister?" he asked me.
"Mameha?" I said. "I don't understand. What does Mameha have to do with it?"
"You really don't know, do you?"
"Know what, Chairman?"
"Sayuri, I am the one who asked Mameha to take you under her care. I told her about a beautiful young girl I'd met, with startling gray eyes, and ask that she help you if she ever came upon you in Gion. I said I would cover her expenses if necessary, and she did come upon you, only a few months later. From what she's told me over the years, you would certainly never have become a geisha without her help." It's almost impossible to describe the effect the chairman's words had on me. I'd always taken it for granted that Mameha's mission had been personal, to rid herself and Gion of Hatsumomo. Now that I understood her real motive, that I'd come under her tutelage because of the chairman, well, I felt I would have to look back at all the comments she'd ever made to me and wonder about the real meaning behind them. And it wasn't just Mameha who'd suddenly transformed in my eyes. Even I seemed to myself to be a different woman. When my gaze fell upon my hands in my lap, I saw them as hands the chairman had made. I felt exhilarated and frightened and grateful all at once. I moved away from the table to bow and express my gratitude to him, but before I could even do it, I had to say, "Chairman, forgive me, but I so wish that at some time years ago you could have told me about all of this. I can't say how much it would have meant to me." "There's a reason why I never could, Sayuri, and why I had to insist that Mameha not tell you either. It has to do with Nobu." To hear the mention of Nobu's name, all the feeling drained out of me, for I had the sudden notion that I understood where the chairman had been leading all along. "Chairman," I said, "I know I've been unworthy of your kindness. This past weekend, when I..."
"I confess, Sayuri," he interrupted, "that what happened on Amami has been very much on my mind."
I could feel the chairman looking at me. I couldn't possibly have looked back at him.
"There's something I want to discuss with you," he went on. "I've been wondering all day how to go about it. I keep thinking of something that happened many years ago. I'm sure there must be a better way to explain myself, but I do hope you'll understand what I'm trying to say."
Here he paused to take off his jacket and fold it on the mats beside him. I could smell the starch in his shirt, which made me think of visiting the general at the Soroya Inn and his room that often smelled of ironing.
"Back when Iwamura Electric was still a young company," the chairman began, "I came to know a man named Ikeda, who worked for one of our suppliers on the other side of town. He was a genius at solving wiring problems. Sometimes when we had difficulty with an installation, we asked to borrow him for a day, and he straightened everything out for us. Then, one afternoon when I was rushing home from work, I happened to run into him at the pharmacist. He told me he was feeling very relaxed because he'd quit his job. When I asked him why he'd done it, he said, 'The time came to quit, so I quit.' Well, I hired him right there on the spot. Then, a few weeks later, I asked him again, 'Ikeda-san, why did you quit your job across town?' He said to me, 'Mr. Iwamura, for years I wanted to come and work for your company, but you never asked me. You always called on me when you had a problem, but you never asked me to work for you. Then, one day, I realized that you never would ask me, because you didn't want to hire me away from one of your suppliers and jeopardize your business relationship. Only if I quit my job first, would you then have the opportunity to hire me. So I quit.'"
I knew the chairman was waiting for me to respond, but I didn't dare speak.
"Now I've been thinking," he went on, "that perhaps your encounter with the minister was like Ikeda quitting his job. And I'll tell you why this thought has been on my mind. It's something Pumpkin said after she took me down to the theater. I was extremely angry with her, and I demanded she tell me why she'd done it. For the longest time, she wouldn't even speak. Then she told me something that made no sense at first. She said you'd asked her to bring Nobu."
"Chairman, please," I began unsteadily. "I made such a terrible mistake."
"Before you say anything further, I only want to know why you did this thing. Perhaps you felt you were doing Iwamura Electric some sort of favor, I don't know, or maybe you owed the minister something I'm unaware of."
I must have given my head a little shake because the chairman stopped speaking at once. "I'm deeply ashamed, Chairman," I managed to say at last. "But my motives were purely personal." After a long moment, he sighed and held out his sake cup. I poured for him, with the feeling that my hands were someone else's, and then he tossed the sake into his mouth and held it there before swallowing.
Seeing him with his mouth momentarily full made me think of myself as an empty vessel swelled up with shame.
"All right, Sayuri," he said. "I'll tell you exactly why I'm asking. It will be impossible for you to grasp why I've come here tonight or why I've treated you as I have over the years if you don't understand the nature of my relationship with Nobu. Believe me, I'm more aware than anyone of how difficult he can sometimes be. But he is a genius. I value him more than an entire team of men combined."
I couldn't think of what to do or say, so with trembling hands I picked up the vial to pour more sake for the chairman. I took it as a very bad sign that he didn't lift his cup.
"One day, when I'd known you only a short time," he went on, "Nobu brought you a gift of a comb and gave it to you in front of everyone at the party. I hadn't realized how much affection he felt for you until that very moment. I'm sure there were other signs before, but somehow I must have overlooked them. And when I realized how he felt, the way he looked at you that evening, well, I knew in a moment that I couldn't possibly take away from him the thing he so clearly wanted. It never diminished my concern for your welfare. In fact, as the years have gone by, it has become increasingly difficult for me to listen dispassionately while Nobu talks about you."
Here the chairman paused and said,
"Sayuri, are you listening to me?"
"Yes, chairman, of course."
"There's no reason you would know this, but I owe Nobu a great debt. It's true I'm the founder of the company and his boss, but when Iwamura Electric was still quite young, we had a terrible problem with cash flow and very nearly went out of business. I wasn't willing to give up control of the company, and I wouldn't listen to Nobu when he insisted on bringing in investors. He won in the end, even though it caused a rift between us for a time. He offered to resign, and I almost let him. But of course, he was completely right and I was wrong. I'd have lost the company without him. How do you repay a man for something like that? Do you know why I'm called chairman and not president? It's because I resigned the title so Nobu would take it, though he tried to refuse. This is why I made up my mind the moment I became aware of his affection for you, that I would keep my interest in you hidden so that Nobu could have you. Life has been cruel to him, Sayuri. He's had too little kindness."
In all my years as a geisha, I'd never been able to convince myself, even for a moment, that the chairman felt any special regard for me, and now to know that he'd intended me for Nobu...
"I never meant to pay you so little attention," he went on, "but surely you realize that if he'd ever picked up the slightest hint of my feelings, he would have given you up in an instant."
Since my girlhood, I'd dreamed that one day the chairman would tell me he cared for me, and yet I'd never quite believed it would really happen. I certainly hadn't imagined he might tell me what I hoped to hear, and also that Nobu was my destiny. Perhaps the goal I'd sought in life would elude me, but at least during this one moment it was within my power to sit in the room with the chairman and tell him how deeply I felt. "Please forgive me for what I'm about to say," I finally managed to begin. I tried to continue, but somehow my throat made up its mind to swallow, though I can't think what I was swallowing, unless it was a little knot of emotion I pushed back down, because there was no room in my face for any more. "I have great affection for Nobu, but what I did on Amami..." Here I had to hold a burning in my throat a long moment before I could speak again. "What I did on Amami, I did because of my feelings for you, Chairman. Every step I have taken in my life since I was a child in Gion, I have taken in the hope of bringing myself closer to you." When I said these words, all the heat in my body seemed to rise to my face. I felt I might float up into the air just like a piece of ash from a fire, unless I could focus on something in the room. I tried to find a smudge on the tabletop, but already the table itself was glazing over and disappearing in my vision. "Look at me, Sayuri." I wanted to do as the chairman asked, but I couldn't. "How strange," he went on quietly, almost to himself, "that the same woman who looked me so frankly in the eye as a girl many years ago can't bring herself to do it now." Perhaps it ought to have been a simple task to raise my eyes and look at the chairman, and yet somehow I couldn't have felt more nervous if I'd stood alone on a stage with all of Kyoto watching. We were sitting at a corner of the table, so close that when at length I wiped my eyes and raised them to meet his, I could see the dark rings around his irises. I wondered if perhaps I should look away and make a little bow and then offer to pour him a cup of sake, but no gesture would have been enough to break the tension. As I was thinking these thoughts, the chairman moved the vial of sake and the cup aside and then reached out his hand and took the collar of my robe to draw me toward him. In a moment, our faces were so close, I could feel the warmth of his skin. I was still struggling to understand what was happening to me and what I ought to do or say, and then the chairman pulled me closer and he kissed me. It may surprise you to hear that this was the first time in my life anyone had ever really kissed me. General Tottori had sometimes pressed his lips against mine when he was my Donna, but it had been utterly passionless. I'd wondered at the time if he simply needed somewhere to rest his face. Even Yasuda Akira, the man who'd bought me a kimono and whom I'd seduced one night at the Tatematsu tea house, must have kissed me dozens of times on my neck and face, but he never really touched my lips with his. And so you can imagine that this kiss, the first real one of my life, seemed to me more intimate than anything I'd ever experienced. I had the feeling I was taking something from the chairman and that he was giving something to me, something more private than anyone had ever given me before. There was a certain very startling taste, as distinctive as any fruit or sweet, and when I tasted it, my shoulders sagged and my stomach swelled up, because for some reason it called to mind a dozen different scenes I couldn't think why I should remember. I thought of the head of steam when the cook lifted the lid from the rice cooker in the kitchen of our okya. I saw a picture in my mind of the little alleyway that was the main thoroughfare of Pontocho, as I'd seen it one evening crowded with well-wishers after Kichi Saburo's last performance the day he'd retired from the Kabuki Theater. I'm sure I might have thought of 100 other things, for it was as if all the boundaries in my mind had broken down and my memories were running free. But then the chairman leaned back away from me again with one of his hands upon my neck. He was so close I could see the moisture glistening on his lip and still smell the kiss we'd just ended.
"Chairman," I said, "why?"
"Why what?"
"Why everything. Why have you kissed me? You've just been speaking of me as a gift to Nobu-san."
"Nobu gave you up, Sayuri. I've taken nothing away from him." In my confusion of feelings, I couldn't quite understand what he meant. "When I saw you there with the minister, you had a look in your eyes, just like the one I saw so many years ago at the Shirakawa stream," he told me. "You seemed so desperate, like you might drown if someone didn't save you. After Pumpkin told me you'd intended the encounter for Nobu's eyes, I made up my mind to tell him what I'd seen. And when he reacted so angrily, well, if he couldn't forgive you for what you'd done, it was clear to me he was never truly your destiny." One afternoon, back when I was a child in Yoroido, a little boy named Gisuki climbed a tree to jump into the pond. He climbed much higher than he should have. The water wasn't deep enough. But when we told him not to jump, he was afraid to climb back down because of rocks under the tree. I ran to the village to find his father, Mr. Yamashita, who came walking so calmly up the hill, I wondered if he realized what danger his son was in. He stepped underneath the tree just as the boy, unaware of his father's presence, lost his grip and fell. Mr. Yamashita caught him as easily as if someone had dropped a sack into his arms and set him upright. We all of us cried out in delight and skipped around at the edge of the pond while Gisuki stood blinking his eyes very quickly, little tears of astonishment gathering on his lashes. Now I knew exactly what Gisuki must have felt. I had been plummeting toward the rocks, and the chairman had stepped out to catch me. I was so overcome with relief I couldn't even wipe away the tears that spilled from the corners of my eyes. His shape was a blur before me, but I could see him moving closer, and in a moment he'd gathered me up in his arms, just as if I were a blanket. His lips went straight for the little triangle of flesh where the edges of my kimono came together at my throat, and when I felt his breath on my neck and the sense of urgency with which he almost consumed me, I couldn't help thinking of a moment years earlier when I'd stepped into the kitchen of the Okia and found one of the maids leaning over the sink, trying to cover up the ripe pear she held to her mouth, its juices running down onto her neck. She'd had such a craving for it, she'd said, and begged me not to tell Mother. Chapter 35. Now, nearly 40 years later, I sit here looking back on that evening with the chairman as the moment when all the grieving voices within me fell silent. Since the day I'd left Yoroido, I'd done nothing but worry that every turn of life's wheel would bring yet another obstacle into my path. And of course, it was the worrying and the struggle that had always made life so vividly real to me. When we fight upstream against a rocky undercurrent, every foothold takes on a kind of urgency. But life softened into something much more pleasant after the chairman became my Donna. I began to feel like a tree whose roots had at last broken into the rich, wet soil deep beneath the surface. I'd never before had occasion to think of myself as more fortunate than others, and yet now I was. Though I must say, I lived in that contented state a long while before I was finally able to look back and admit how desolate my life had once been. I'm sure I could never have told my story otherwise. I don't think any of us can speak frankly about pain until we are no longer enduring it. On the afternoon when the chairman and I drank sake together in a ceremony at the Ichiriki Tea House, something peculiar happened. I don't know why, but when I sipped from the smallest of the three cups we used, I let the sake wash over my tongue, and a single drop of it spilled from the corner of my mouth. I was wearing a five-crested kimono of black with a dragon woven in gold and red encircling the hem up to my thighs. I recall watching the drop fall beneath my arm and roll down the black silk on my thigh until it came to a stop at the heavy silver threads of the dragon's teeth. I'm sure most geisha would call it a bad omen that I'd spilled sake, but to me, that droplet of moisture that had slipped from me like a tear seemed almost to tell the story of my life. It fell through empty space with no control whatsoever over its destiny, rolled along a path of silk, and somehow came to rest there on the teeth of that dragon. I thought of the petals I'd thrown into the Kama River shallows outside Mr. Arashino's workshop, imagining they might find their way to the chairman. It seemed to me that somehow, perhaps they had. In the foolish hopes that had been so dear to me since girlhood, I'd always imagined my life would be perfect if I ever came to be the chairman's mistress. It's a childish thought, and yet I'd carried it with me even as an adult. I ought to have known better. How many times already had I encountered the painful lesson that, although we may wish for the barb to be pulled from our flesh, it leaves behind a welt that doesn't heal. In banishing Nobu from my life forever, it wasn't just that I lost his friendship, I also ended up banishing myself from Gion. The reason is so simple, I ought to have known beforehand it would happen. A man who has won a prize coveted by his friend faces a difficult choice. He must either hide his prize away where the friend will never see it, if he can, or suffer damage to the friendship. This was the very problem that had arisen between Pumpkin and me. Our friendship had never recovered after my adoption. So, although the chairman's negotiations with Mother to be my Donna dragged out over several months, in the end it was agreed that I would no longer work as a geisha. I certainly wasn't the first geisha to leave Gion. Besides those who ran away, some married and left as wives, others withdrew to set up tea houses or okia of their own. In my case, however, I was trapped in a peculiar middle ground. The chairman wanted me out of Gion to keep me out of sight of Nobu, but he certainly wasn't going to marry me. He was already married. Probably the perfect solution, and the one that the chairman proposed, would have been to set me up with my own tea house or inn, one that Nobu would never have visited. But Mother was unwilling to have me leave the Okia. She would have earned no revenues from my relationship with the chairman if I had ceased to be a member of the Nitta family, you see. This is why, in the end, the chairman agreed to pay the Okia a very considerable sum each month, on the condition that Mother permit me to end my career. I continued to live in the Okia, just as I had for so many years, but I no longer went to the little school in the mornings, or made the rounds of Gion to pay my respects on social occasions, and of course, I no longer entertained during the evenings. Because I'd set my sights on becoming a geisha only to win the affections of the chairman, probably I ought to have felt no sense of loss in withdrawing from Gion. And yet, over the years, I've developed many rich friendships, not only with other geisha, but with many of the men I'd come to know. I wasn't banished from the company of other women just because I'd ceased entertaining, but those who make a living in Gion have little time for socializing. I often felt jealous when I saw two geisha hurrying to their next engagement, laughing together over what had happened at the last one. I didn't envy them the uncertainty of their existence, but I did envy that sense of promise I could well remember, that the evening ahead might yet hold some mischievous pleasure. I did see Mameha frequently. We had tea together at least several times a week. Considering all that she had done for me since childhood, and the special role she'd played in my life on the chairman's behalf, you can imagine how much I felt myself in her debt. One day, in a shop, I came upon a silk painting from the 18th century showing a woman teaching a young girl calligraphy. The teacher had an exquisite oval face and watched over her pupil with such benevolence it made me think of Mameha at once, and I bought it for her as a gift. On the rainy afternoon when she hung it on the wall of her dreary apartment, I found myself listening to the traffic that hissed by on Higashi Oji Avenue. I couldn't help remembering, with a terrible feeling of loss, her elegant apartment from years earlier, and the enchanting sound out those windows of water rushing over the knee-high cascade in the Shirakawa stream. Gion itself had seemed to me like an exquisite piece of antique fabric back then, but so much had changed. Now, Mameha's simple one-room apartment had mats the color of stale tea and smelled of herbal potions from the Chinese pharmacy below, so much so that her kimono themselves sometimes gave off a faint medicinal odor. After she'd hung the ink painting on the wall and admired it for a while, she came back to the table. She sat with her hands around her steaming teacup, peering into it as though she expected to find the words she was looking for. I was surprised to see the tendons in her hands beginning to show themselves from age. At last, with a trace of sadness, she said, "How curious it is what the future brings us. You must take care, Sayori, never to expect too much." I'm quite sure she was right. I'd have had an easier time over the following years if I hadn't gone on believing that Nobu would one day forgive me. In the end, I had to give up questioning Mameha whether he'd asked about me. It pained me terribly to see her sigh and give me a long, sad look, as if to say she was sorry I hadn't known better than to hope for such a thing. In the spring of the year after I became his mistress, the chairman purchased a luxurious house in the northeast of Kyoto and named it Aishin An, Prosperous Truth Retreat. It was intended for guests of the company, but in fact the chairman made more use of it than anyone. This was where he and I met to spend the evenings together 3 or 4 nights a week, sometimes even more. On his busiest days he arrived so late he wanted only to soak in a hot bath while I talked with him and then afterward fall asleep. But most evenings he arrived around sunset or soon after and ate his dinner while we chatted and watched the servants light the lanterns in the garden. Usually, when he first came, the chairman talked for a time about his work day. He might tell me about troubles with a new product or about a traffic accident involving a truckload of parts or some such thing. Of course, I was happy to sit and listen, but I understood perfectly well that the chairman wasn't telling these things to me because he wanted me to know them. He was clearing them from his mind, just like draining water from a bucket. So I listened closely, not to his words, but to the tone of his voice. Because in the same way that sound rises as a bucket is emptied, I could hear the chairman's voice softening as he spoke. When the moment was right, I changed the subject, and soon we were talking about nothing so serious as business, but about everything else instead, such as what had happened to him that morning on the way to work, or something about the film we may have watched a few nights earlier, there at the Aishin An, or perhaps I told him a funny story I might have heard from Mameha, who on some evenings came to join us there. In any case, this simple process of first draining the chairman's mind and then relaxing him with playful conversation had the same effect water has on a towel that has dried stiffly in the sun. When he first arrived and I washed his hands with a hot cloth, his fingers felt rigid, like heavy twigs. After we had talked for a time, they bent as gracefully as if he were sleeping. I expected that this would be my life, entertaining the chairman in the evenings and occupying myself during the daylight hours in any way I could. But in the fall of 1952, I accompanied the chairman on his second trip to the United States. He'd traveled there the winter before, and no experience of his life had ever made such an impression on him. He said he felt he understood for the first time the true meaning of prosperity. Most Japanese at this time had electricity only during certain hours, for example, but the lights in American cities burned around the clock. And while we in Kyoto were proud that the floor of our new train station was constructed of concrete rather than old-fashioned wood, the floors of American train stations were made of solid marble. Even in small American towns, the movie theaters were as grand as our national theater, said the chairman, and the public bathrooms everywhere were spotlessly clean. What amazed him most of all was that every family in the United States owned a refrigerator, which could be purchased with the wages earned by an average worker in only a month's time. In Japan, a worker needed 15 months' wages to buy such a thing. Few families could afford it. In any case, as I say, the chairman permitted me to accompany him on his second trip to America. I traveled alone by rail to Tokyo, and from there we flew together on an airplane bound for Hawaii, where we spent a few remarkable days. The chairman bought me a bathing suit, the first I'd ever owned, and I sat wearing it on the beach with my hair hanging neatly at my shoulders, just like other women around me. Hawaii reminded me strangely of Amami. I worried that the same thought might occur to the chairman, but if it did, he said nothing about it. From Hawaii, we continued to Los Angeles and finally to New York. I knew nothing about the United States except what I'd seen in the movies. I don't think I quite believed that the great buildings of New York City really existed. And when I settled at last into my room at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel and looked out the window at the mountainous buildings around me and the smooth, clean streets below, I had the feeling I was seeing a world in which anything was possible. I confess I'd expected to feel like a baby who has been taken away from its mother. For I had never before left Japan, and couldn't imagine that a setting as alien as New York City would make me anything but fearful. Perhaps it was the chairman's enthusiasm that helped me to approach my visit there with such goodwill. He'd taken a separate room, which he used mostly for business, but every night he came to stay with me in the suite he'd arranged. Often I awoke in that strange bed and turned to see him there in the dark, sitting in a chair by the window, holding the sheer curtain open, staring at Park Avenue below. One time after 2 o'clock in the morning, he took me by the hand and pulled me to the window to see a young couple dressed as if they'd come from a ball, kissing under the street lamp on the corner. Over the next 3 years, I traveled with the chairman twice more to the United States. While he attended to business during the day, my maid and I took in the museums and restaurants, and even a ballet, which I found breathtaking. Strangely, one of the few Japanese restaurants we were able to find in New York was now under the management of a chef I'd known well in Gion before the war. During lunch one afternoon, I found myself in his private room in the back, entertaining a number of men I hadn't seen in years, the vice president of Nippon Telephone and Telegraph, the new Japanese consul general, who had formerly been mayor of Kobe, a professor of political science from Kyoto University. It was almost like being back in Gion once again. In the summer of 1956, the chairman, who had 2 daughters by his wife but no son, arranged for his eldest daughter to marry a man named Nishioko Minoru. The chairman's intention was that Mr. Nishioka take the family name of Iwamura and become his heir. But at the last moment, Mr. Nishioka had a change of heart and informed the chairman that he had not intended to go through with the wedding. He was a very temperamental young man, but in the chairman's estimation quite brilliant. For a week or more, the chairman was upset and snapped at his servants and me without the least provocation. I'd never seen him so disturbed by anything. No one ever told me why Nishioka Minoru changed his mind, but no one had to. During the previous summer, the founder of one of Japan's largest insurance companies had dismissed his son as president and turned his company over instead to a much younger man, his illegitimate son by a Tokyo geisha. It caused quite a scandal at the time. Things of this sort had happened before in Japan, but usually on a much smaller scale, in family-owned kimono stores or sweet shops, businesses of that sort. The insurance company director described his firstborn in the newspapers as an earnest young man whose talents unfortunately can't be compared with blank. and here he named his illegitimate son, without ever giving any hint of their relationship. But it made no difference whether he gave a hint of it or not. Everyone knew the truth soon enough. Now, if you were to imagine that Nishioka Minoru, after already having agreed to become the chairman's heir, had discovered some new bit of information, such as that the chairman had recently fathered an illegitimate son, well, I'm sure that in this case, his reluctance to go through with the marriage would probably seem quite understandable. It was widely known that the chairman lamented having no son and was deeply attached to his two daughters. Was there any reason to think he wouldn't become equally attached to an illegitimate son? Enough, perhaps, to change his mind before death and turn over to him the company he'd built? As to the question of whether or not I really had given birth to a son of the chairman's, if I had, I'd certainly be reluctant to talk too much about him, for fear that his identity might become publicly known. It would be in no one's best interest for such a thing to happen. The best course, I feel, is for me to say nothing at all. I'm sure you will understand. A week or so after Nishioka Minoru's change of heart, I decided to raise a very delicate subject with the chairman. We were at the Eishinan, sitting outdoors after dinner on the veranda overlooking the moss garden. The chairman was brooding and hadn't spoken a word since before dinner was served. "Have I mentioned to Donna-sama," I began, "that I've had the strangest feeling lately?" I glanced at him, but I could see no sign that he was even listening. "I keep thinking of the Ichiriki tea house," I went on, "and truthfully, I'm beginning to recognize how much I miss entertaining." The chairman just took a bite of his ice cream and then set his spoon down on the dish again. "Of course I can never go back to work in Gion, I know that perfectly well. And yet, I wonder, Donna-sama, isn't there a place for a small tea house in New York City?" "I don't know what you're talking about," he said. "There's no reason why you should want to leave Japan." "Japanese businessmen and politicians are showing up in New York these days as commonly as turtles plopping into a pond," I said. "Most of them are men I've known already for years. It's true that leaving Japan would be an abrupt change, but considering that Donna-sama will be spending more and more of his time in the United States..." I knew this was true because he'd already told me about his plan to open a branch of his company there. "I'm in no mood for this, Sayuri," he began. I think he intended to say something further, but I went on as though I hadn't heard him. "They say that a child raised between two cultures often has a very difficult time," I said. "So naturally, a mother who moves with her child to a place like the United States would probably be wise to make it her permanent home." "Sayuri, which is to say," I went on, "that a woman who made such a choice would probably never bring her child back to Japan at all." By this time, the chairman must have understood what I was suggesting, that I remove from Japan the only obstacle in the way of Nishioka Minoru's adoption as his heir. He wore a startled look for an instant, and then, probably as the image formed in his mind of my leaving him, his peevish humor seemed to crack open like an egg, and out of the corner of his eye came a single tear, which he blinked away just as swiftly as swatting a fly. In August of that same year, I moved to New York City to set up my own very small tea house for Japanese businessmen and politicians traveling through the United States. Of course, Mother tried to ensure that any business I started in New York City would be an extension of the Nitta Okia, but the chairman refused to consider any such arrangement. Mother had power over me as long as I remained in Gion, but I broke my ties with her by leaving. The chairman sent in two of his accountants to make sure that Mother gave me every last yen to which I was entitled. I can't pretend I didn't feel afraid so many years ago when the door of my apartment here at the Waldorf Towers closed behind me for the first time, but New York is an exciting city. Before long, it came to feel at least as much a home to me as Gion ever did. In fact, as I look back, the memories of many long weeks I've spent here with the chairman have made my life in the United States even richer in some ways than it was in Japan. My little tea house on the second floor of an old club off Fifth Avenue was modestly successful from the very beginning. A number of geisha have come from Gion to work with me there, and even Mameha sometimes visits. Nowadays, I go there myself only when close friends or old acquaintances have come to town. I spend my time in a variety of other ways instead. In the mornings, I often join a group of Japanese writers and artists from the area to study subjects that interest us, such as poetry or music or, during 1 month-long session, the history of New York City. I lunch with a friend most days, and in the afternoons I kneel before my makeup stand to prepare for one party or another, sometimes here in my very own apartment. When I lift the brocade cover on my mirror, I can't help but remember the milky odor of the white makeup I so often wore in Guyon. I dearly wish I could go back there to visit, but on the other hand, I think I would be disturbed to see all the changes. When friends bring photographs from their trips to Kyoto, I often think that Guyon has thinned out like a poorly kept garden, increasingly overrun with weeds. After Mother's death a number of years ago, for example, the Nitta Okia was torn down and replaced with a tiny concrete building housing a bookshop on the ground floor and 2 apartments overhead. 800 geisha worked in Guyon when I first arrived there. Now the number is less than 60, with only a handful of apprentices, and it dwindles further every day. Because, of course, the pace of change never slows, even when we've convinced ourselves it will. On his last visit to New York City, the chairman and I took a walk through Central Park. We happened to be talking about the past, and when we came to a path through the pine trees, the chairman stopped suddenly. He'd often told me of the pines bordering the street outside Osaka on which he'd grown up. I knew, as I watched him, that he was remembering them. He stood with his 2 frail hands on his cane, and his eyes closed, and breathed in deeply the scent of the past. "Sometimes," he sighed, "I think the things I remember are more real than the things I see." As a younger woman, I believed that passion must surely fade with age, just as a cup left standing in a room will gradually give up its contents to the air. But when the chairman and I returned to my apartment, we drank each other up with so much yearning and need that afterward I felt myself drained of all the things the chairman had taken from me, and yet filled with all that I had taken from him. I fell into a sound sleep, and I dreamed that I was at a banquet back in Guyon, talking with an elderly man who was explaining to me that his wife, whom he'd cared for deeply, wasn't really dead because the pleasure of their time together lived on inside him. While he spoke these words, I drank from a bowl of the most extraordinary soup I'd ever tasted. Every briny sip was a kind of ecstasy. I began to feel that all the people I'd ever known who had died or left me had not in fact gone away, but continued to live on inside me, just as the man's wife lived on inside him. I felt as though I were drinking them all in. My sister Satsu, who had run away and left me so young. My father and mother, Mr. Tanaka, with his perverse view of kindness. Nobu, who could never forgive me. Even the chairman. The soup was filled with all that I'd ever cared for in my life. And while I drank it, this man spoke his words right into my heart. I awoke with tears streaming down my temples, and I took the chairman's hand, fearing that I would never be able to live without him when he died and left me. For he was so frail by then, even there in his sleep, that I couldn't help thinking of my mother back in Yoroido. And yet, when his death happened only a few months later, I understood that he left me at the end of his long life, just as naturally as the leaves fall from the trees. I cannot tell you what it is that guides us in this life, but for me, I fell toward the chairman just as a stone must fall toward the earth. When I cut my lip and met Mr. Tanaka, when my mother died and I was cruelly sold, it was like a stream that falls over rocky cliffs before it can reach the ocean. Even now that he is gone, I have him still, in the richness of my memories. I have lived my life again just telling it to you. It's true that sometimes when I cross Park Avenue, I'm struck with the peculiar sense of how exotic my surroundings are. The yellow taxicabs that go sweeping past, honking their horns. The women with their briefcases, who look so perplexed to see a little old Japanese woman standing on the street corner in kimono. But really, would Yoroido seem any less exotic if I went back there again? As a young girl, I believed my life would never have been a struggle if Mr. Tanaka hadn't torn me away from my tipsy house. But now I know that our world is no more permanent than a wave rising on the ocean. Whatever our struggles and triumphs, however we may suffer them, all too soon they bleed into a wash, just like watery ink on paper.
This has been presented by Random House Audiobooks and Books on Tape.